John stared at the remains of his weapon, dismayed by the loss. Garrow had made it as a birthday present for him over 3 years ago. Since then, hardly a week went by when Aragorn had not used his bow. It had helped him to provide food for his family on numerous occasions when they would have otherwise gone hungry. With it, he had killed his first deer. With it, he had killed his first Urgal. And through it, he had first used magic. Losing his bow was like losing an old friend who could be relied upon in even the worst situation. Saphira sniffed the two pieces of wood dangling from his grip and said,
"It seems you need a new stick-thrower."
He grunted, in no mood to talk, and stomped out to retrieve his arrows. From the open field, he and Saphira flew to the white crags of Telnair and presented themselves to Oromis, who was seated on a stool in front of his hut, gazing out over the cliff with his far-seeing eyes. He said,
"Have you entirely recovered, Aragorn, from the potent magic of the Blood Oath celebration?"
"I have, Master." A long silence followed as Oromis drank from a cup of blackberry tea and resumed contemplating the ancient forest. Aragorn waited without complaint. He was used to such pauses when dealing with the old rider. At length Oromis said,
"Glader explained to me as best he could what was done to you during the celebration. Such a thing has never before occurred in the history of the riders. Once again, the dragons have proved themselves capable of far more than we imagined."
He sipped his tea.
"Glader was uncertain exactly what changes you would experience, so I would like you to describe the full extent of your transformation, including your appearance."
Aragorn quickly summarized how he had been altered, detailing the increased sensitivity of his sight, smell, hearing, and touch, and ending with an account of his clash with Vanna.
"And how," asked Oromis, "do you feel about this? Do you resent that your body was manipulated without your permission?"
"No, no, not at all. I might have resented it before the Battle of Farthendur, but now I'm just grateful that my back doesn't hurt any more. I would have willingly submitted myself to far greater changes in order to escape Durza's curse. No, my only response is gratitude."
Oromis nodded. "I am glad that you are wise enough to take that position, for your gift is worth more than all the gold in the world. With it, I believe that our feet are at last set upon the correct path."
Again he sipped his tea.
"Let us proceed. Saphira, Glader expects you at the Stone of Broken Eggs. Aragorn, you will begin today with the third level of Rimgar if you can. I would know everything you are capable of."
Aragorn started toward the square of tamped earth, where they usually performed the dance of snake and crane, then hesitated when the silver-haired elf remained behind. "Master, won't you join me?" A sad smile graced Oromis's face.
"Not today, Aragorn. The spells required by the Blood Oath celebration exacted a heavy toll from me. That and my condition. It took the last of my strength to come sit outside."
"I am sorry, Master." Does he resent that the dragons didn't choose to heal him as well? Wondered Aragorn. He immediately discounted the thought. Oromis would never be so petty.
"Do not be. It is no fault of yours that I am crippled."
As Aragorn struggled to complete the third level of the Rimgar, it became obvious that he still lacked the elves' balance and flexibility, two attributes that even the elves had to work to acquire. In a way, he welcomed those limitations, for if he was perfect, what was left for him to accomplish? The following weeks were difficult for Aragorn. On one hand, he made enormous progress with his training, mastering subject after subject that had once confounded him. He still found Oromis's lessons challenging, but he no longer felt as if he were drowning in a sea of his own inadequacy. It was easier for Aragorn to read and write, and his increased strength meant that he could now cast elven spells that required so much energy they would kill any normal human. His strength also made him aware of how weak Oromis was compared to other elves. And yet, despite those accomplishments, Aragorn experienced a growing sense of discontent. No matter how hard he tried to forget Arya, every day that passed increased his yearning, an agony made worse by knowing that she did not want to see or talk with him. But more than that, it seemed to him as if an ominous storm was gathering beyond the edge of the horizon, a storm that threatened to break at any moment and sweep across the land, devastating everything in its path. Saphira shared his unease. She said,
"The world is stretched thin, Aragorn. Soon it will snap, and madness will burst forth. What you feel is what we dragons feel, and what the elves feel, the inexorable march of grim fate as the end of our age approaches. Weep for those who will die in the chaos that shall consume Alagazia, and hope that we may win a brighter future by the strength of your sword and shield, and my fangs and talons."
Visions, near and far. The day came when Aragorn went to the glade beyond Oromus's hut, seated himself on the polished white stump in the centre of the mossy hollow, and when he opened his mind to observe the creatures around him, sensed not just the birds, beasts and insects, but also the plants of the forest. The plants possessed a different type of consciousness than animals, slow, deliberate and decentralized, but in their own way just as cognizant of their surroundings as Aragorn himself was. The faint pulse of the plant's awareness bathed the galaxy of stars that wheeled behind his eyes, each bright spark representing a life, in a soft, omnipresent glow. Even the most barren soil teemed with organisms. The land itself was alive and sentient. Intelligent life, he concluded, existed everywhere. As Aragorn immersed himself in the thoughts and feelings of the beings around him, he was able to attain a state of inner peace so profound that during that time he ceased to exist as an individual. He allowed himself to become a non-entity, a void, a receptacle for the voices of the world. Nothing escaped his attention, for his attention was focused on nothing. He was the forest and its inhabitants. "Is that what a god feels like?" wondered Aragorn when he returned to himself. He left the glade, sought out Oromus in his hut, and knelt before the elf, saying, "Master, I have done as you told me to. I listened until I heard no more." Oromis paused in his writing, and with a thoughtful expression looked at Aragorn.
"Tell me."
For an hour and a half, Aragorn waxed eloquent about every aspect of the plants and animals that populated the glade, until Oromis raised his hand and said,
"I am convinced. You heard all there was to hear. But did you understand it all?"
"No, master."
"That is as it should be. Comprehension will come with age. Well done, Aragorn Finiarel. Well done indeed. If you were my student in Illyria, before Galbatorix rose to power, you would have just graduated from your apprenticeship, and would be considered a full member of our order, and accorded the same rights and privileges as even the oldest riders."
Oromis pushed himself up out of his chair, and then remained standing in place, swaying.
"Lend me your shoulder, Aragorn, and help me outside. My limbs betray my will."
Hurrying to his master's side, Aragorn supported the elf's slight weight as Oromis hobbled to the brook that rushed headlong toward the edge of the crags of Telnair.
"Now that you have reached this stage in your education, I can teach you one of the greatest secrets of magic, a secret that even Galbatorix may not know. It is your best hope of matching his power."
The elf's gaze sharpened.
"What is the cost of magic, Aragorn?"
"Energy. A spell costs the same amount of energy as it would to complete the task through mundane means."
Oromis nodded. "And where does the energy come from?"
"The spellcaster's body."
"Does it have to?"
Aragorn's mind raced as he considered the awesome implications of Oromis's question.
"You mean it can come from other sources?"
"That is exactly what happens whenever Saphira assists you with a spell."
"Yes, but she and I share a unique connection," protested Aragorn. "Our bond is the reason I can draw upon her strength. To do that with someone else, I would have to enter..." He trailed off as he realized what Oromis was driving at.
"You would have to enter the consciousness of the being or beings who was going to provide the energy," said Oromis, completing Aragorn's thought. "Today you prove that you can do just that with even the smallest form of life. Now,
He stopped and pressed a hand against his chest as he coughed, then continued,
"I want you to extract a sphere of water from the stream, using only the energy you can glean from the forest around you."
"Yes, master."
As Aragorn reached out to the nearby plants and animals, he felt Oromus's mind brush against his own, the elf watching and judging his progress. Frowning with concentration, Aragorn endeavoured to eke the needed force from the environment and hold it within himself until he was ready to release the magic.
"Aragorn, do not take it from me. I am weak enough as is."
Startled, Aragorn realized that he had included Oromus in his search.
"I'm sorry, master," he said, chastised.
He resumed the process, careful to avoid draining the elf's vitality, and when he was ready, commanded,
"Up!"
Silent as the night, a sphere of water a foot wide rose from the brook until it floated at eye level across from Aragorn. And while Aragorn experienced the usual strain that results from intense effort, the spell itself caused him no fatigue. The sphere was only in the air for a moment, when a wave of death rolled through the smaller creatures Aragorn was in contact with. A line of ants keeled over motionless. A baby mouse gasped and entered the void as it lost the strength to keep its heart beating. Countless plants withered and crumbled and became inert as dust. Aragorn flinched, horrified by what he had caused. Given his new respect for the sanctity of life, he found the crime appalling. What made it worse was that he was intimately linked with each being as it ceased to exist. It was as if he himself were dying over and over. He severed the flow of magic, letting the sphere of water splash across the ground, and then whirled on Oromus and growled,
"You knew that would happen!"
An expression of profound sorrow engulfed the ancient rider.
"It was necessary," he replied.
"Necessary that so many had to die?"
"Necessary that you understand the terrible price of using this type of magic. Mere words cannot convey the feeling of having those whose minds you share die. You had to experience it for yourself."
"I won't do that again," vowed Aragorn.
"Nor will you have to. If you are disciplined, you can choose to draw the power only from plants and animals that can withstand the loss. It's impractical in battle, but you may do so in your lessons."
Oromus gestured at him, and still simmering, Aragorn allowed the elf to lean on him as they returned to the hut.
"You see why this technique was not taught to younger riders. If it were to become known to a spellweaver of evil disposition, he or she could wreak vast amounts of destruction, especially since it would be difficult to stop anyone with access to so much power."
Once they were back inside, the elf sighed, lowered himself into his chair, and pressed the tips of his fingers together. Aragorn sat as well.
"Since it's possible to absorb energy from..." He waved his hand. "From life. Is it also possible to absorb it directly from light or fire, or from any of the other forms of energy?"
"Ah, Aragorn, if it were, we could destroy Galbatorix in an instant. We can exchange energy with other living beings. We can use that energy to move our bodies or to fuel a spell, and we can even store that energy in certain objects for later use. But we cannot assimilate the fundamental forces of nature. Reason says that it can be done, but no one has managed to devise a spell that allows it."
9 days later, Aragorn presented himself to Oromus and said,
"Master, it struck me last night that neither you nor the hundreds of elven scrolls I've read have mentioned your religion. What do elves believe?"
A long sigh was Oromus's first answer. "Then, we believe that the world behaves according to certain inviolable rules, and that by persistent effort we can discover those rules and use them to predict events when circumstances repeat."
Aragorn blinked.
That did not tell him what he wanted to know. "But who or what do you worship?"
"Nothing."
"You worship the concept of nothing?"
"No, Aragorn, we do not worship at all."
The thought was so alien it took Aragorn several moments to grasp what Oromus meant. The villagers of Carvajal lacked a single overriding doctrine,
but they did share a collection of superstitions and rituals, most of which concerned warding off bad luck. During the course of his training, it had dawned upon Aragorn that many of the phenomena that the villagers attributed to supernatural sources were in fact natural processes, such as when he learned in his meditations that maggots hatched from fly eggs instead of spontaneously arising from the dirt as he had thought before. Nor did it make sense for him to put out an offering of food to keep sprites from turning the milk sour, when he knew that sour milk was actually caused by a proliferation of tiny organisms in the liquid. Still, Aragorn remained convinced that otherworldly forces influenced the world in mysterious ways, a belief that his exposure to the dwarves' religion had bolstered. He said, "Where do you think the world came from, then, if it wasn't created by the gods?"
"Which gods, Aragorn?"
"Your gods, the dwarf gods, our gods. Someone must have created it."
Aramis raised an eyebrow.
"I would not necessarily agree with you. But be as that may, I cannot prove that gods do not exist. Nor can I prove that the world and everything in it was not created by an entity or entities in the distant past. But I can tell you that in the millennia we elves have studied nature, we have never witnessed an instance where the rules that govern the world have been broken. That is, we have never seen a miracle. Many events have defied our ability to explain, but we are convinced that we failed because we are still woefully ignorant about the universe, and not because a deity altered the workings of nature."
"A god wouldn't have to alter nature to accomplish his will," asserted Aragorn. "He could do it within the system that already exists. He could use magic to affect events."
Aramis smiled.
"Very true. But ask yourself this, Aragorn. If gods exist, have they been good custodians of Alagaesia? Death, sickness, poverty, tyranny, and countless other miseries stalk the land. If this is the handiwork of divine beings, then they are to be rebelled against and overthrown, not given obeisance, obedience, and reverence."
"The dwarves believe..."
"Exactly. The dwarves believe. When it comes to certain matters, they rely upon faith rather than reason. They have even been known to ignore proven facts that contradict their dogma."
"Like what?" demanded Aragorn.
"Dwarf priests use coral as proof that stone is alive and can grow, which also corroborates their story that Helsvog formed the race of dwarves out of granite. But we elves discovered that coral is actually an exoskeleton secreted by minuscule animals that live inside the coral. Any magician can sense the animals if he opens his mind. We explained this to the dwarves, but they refused to listen, saying that the life we felt resides in every kind of stone, although their priests are the only ones who are supposed to be able to detect the life in landlocked stones." For a long time, Aragorn stared out the window, turning Aramis's words over in his mind.
"You don't believe in an afterlife, then?"
"From what Glader said, you already knew that."
"And you don't put stock in gods?"
"We give credence only to that which we can prove exists. Since we cannot find evidence that gods, miracles, and other supernatural things are real, we do not trouble ourselves about them. If that were to change, if Helsvog were to reveal himself to us, then we would accept the new information and revise our position."
"It seems a cold world without something more."
"On the contrary," said Aramis, "it is a better world, a place where we are responsible for our own actions, where we can be kind to one another because we want to, and because it is the right thing to do, instead of being frightened into behaving by the threat of divine punishment. I won't tell you what to believe, Aragorn. It is far better to be taught to think critically and then be allowed to make your own decisions than to have someone else's notions thrust upon you. You asked after our religion, and I have answered you true. Make of it what you will."
Their discussion, coupled with his previous worries, left Aragorn so disturbed that he had difficulty concentrating on his studies in the following days. Even when Aramis began to show him how to sing to plants, which Aragorn had been eager to learn. Aragorn recognized that his own experiences had already led him to adopt a more sceptical attitude. In principle, he agreed with much of what Aramis had said. The problem he struggled with, though, was that if the elves were right, it meant that nearly all the humans and dwarves were deluded. Something Aragorn found difficult to accept. "That many people can't be mistaken," he insisted to himself. When he asked Zephira about it, she said,
"It matters little to me, Aragorn. Dragons have never believed in higher powers. Why should we, when deer and other prey consider us to be a higher power?"
He laughed at that.
"Only do not ignore reality in order to comfort yourself, for once you do, you make it easy for others to deceive you."
That night, Aragorn's uncertainties burst forth in his waking dreams, which raged like a wounded bear through his mind, tearing disparate images from his memories and mixing them into such a clamour he felt as if he were transported back into the confusion of the battle under Farthendur. He saw Garrow lying dead in Horst's house, then Brom dead in the lonely sandstone cave, and then the face of Angela the herbalist, who whispered, "Beware, Arjatlam, betrayal is clear, and it will come from within your family. Beware, Shadeslayer." Then the crimson sky was torn apart, and Aragorn again beheld the two armies from his premonition in the Beor Mountains. The banks of warriors collided upon an orange and yellow field, accompanied by the harsh screams of gorecrows and the whistle of black arrows. The earth itself seemed to burn. Green flames belched from scorched holes that dotted the ground, charring the mangled corpses left in the army's wake. He heard the roar of a gigantic beast from above that rapidly... Aragorn jolted upright in bed and scrabbled at the dwarf necklace, which burned at his throat. Using his tunic to protect his hand, he pulled the silver hammer away from his skin and then sat and waited in the dark, his heart thudding from the surprise. He felt his strength ebb as Ganel's spell thwarted whoever was trying to scry him and Zephira. Once again, he wondered if Galbatorix himself was behind the spell, or if it was one of the king's pet magicians. Aragorn frowned and released the hammer as the metal grew cold again. "Something's wrong, I know that much, and I've known it for a while, as has Zephira." Too uneasy to resume the trance-like state that had replaced sleep for him, he crept from their bedroom without waking Zephira, and climbed the spiral staircase to the study. There he unshuttered a white lantern and read one of Annalicia's epics until sunrise in an attempt to calm himself. Just as Aragorn put away the scroll, Blagden flew through the open portal in the eastern wall and with a flutter of wings landed on the corner of the carved writing desk. The white raven fixed his beady eyes on Aragorn and croaked,
"Weirda!"
Aragorn inclined his head. "And may the stars watch over you, Master Blagden." The raven hopped closer. He cocked his head to the side and uttered a barking cough, as if he were clearing his throat, then recited in his hoarse voice,
"My beak and bone, mine blackened stone, sees rooks and crooks and bloody brooks."
"What does that mean?" asked Aragorn. Blagden shrugged and repeated the verse. When Aragorn still pressed him for an explanation, the bird ruffled his feathers, appearing displeased, and cackled,
"Son and father alike, both as blind as bats."
"Wait," exclaimed Aragorn, jolting upright. "Do you know my father? Who is he?" Blagden cackled again. This time he seemed to be laughing.
"While two may share two, and one of two is certainly one, one might be two."
"A name, Blagden, give me a name!" When the raven remained silent, Aragorn reached out with his mind, intending to wrench the information from the bird's memories. Blagden was too wily, however. He deflected Aragorn's probe with a flick of his thoughts. Shrieking,
"Weirda!"
he darted forward, plucked a bright glass stopper from an inkwell, and sped away with his trophy clutched in his beak. He dove out of sight before Aragorn could cast a spell to bring him back. Aragorn's stomach knotted as he tried to decipher Blagden's two riddles. The last thing he had expected was to hear his father mentioned in Ellesmere. Finally, he muttered, "That's it. I'll find Blagden later and wring the truth out of him. But right now, I would have to be a half-wit to ignore these portents." He jumped to his feet and ran down the stairs, waking Zephira with his mind and telling her what had transpired during the night. Retrieving his shaving mirror from the wash closet, Aragorn sat between Sephira's two front paws so that she could look over his head and see what he saw.
"Arya won't appreciate it if we intrude on her privacy,"
warned Zephira. "I have to know if she's safe." Saphira accepted that without argument.
How will you find her? You said that after her imprisonment, she erected wards that, like your necklace, prevent anyone from scrying her.
If I can scry the people she's with, I might be able to figure out how Arya is. Concentrating on an image of Nasuada, Eragon passed his hand over the mirror and murmured the traditional phrase, "Dream stare." The mirror shimmered and turned white, except for 9 people clustered around an invisible table. Of them, Eragon was familiar with Nasuada and the Council of Elders, but he could not identify a strange girl hooded in black who lurked behind Nasuada. This puzzled him, for a magician could only scry things that he had already seen, and Eragon was certain he had never laid eyes upon the girl before. He forgot about her, though, as he noticed that the men, and even Nasuada, were armed for battle.
"Let us hear their words," suggested Saphira.
The instant Eragon made the needed alteration to the spell, Nasuada's voice emanated from the mirror. "And confusion will destroy us. Our warriors can afford but one commander during this conflict. Decide who it is to be, Orin, and quickly too."
Eragon heard a disembodied sigh. "As you wish, the position is yours."
"But, sir, she is untried."
"Enough, Erwin," ordered the king. "She has more experience in war than anyone in Cirda, and the Varden are the only force to have defeated one of Galbatorix's armies. If Nasuada were a Cirdan general, which would be peculiar indeed, I admit, you would not hesitate to nominate her for the post. I shall be happy to deal with questions of authority if they arise afterward, for they will mean I'm still on my feet and not lying in a grave. As it is, we are so outnumbered, I fear we are doomed unless Hrothgar can reach us before the end of the week. Now where is that blasted scroll on the supply train? Ah, thank you, Arya. 3 more days without..."
After that, the discussion turned to a shortage of bowstrings, which Eragon could glean nothing useful from, so he ended the spell. The mirror cleared, and he found himself staring at his own face.
"She lives," he murmured.
His relief was overshadowed, though, by the larger meaning of what they had heard. Saphira looked at him.
"We are needed."
"Aye. Why hasn't Doramis told us about this? He must know of it."
"Maybe he wanted to avoid disrupting our training."
Troubled, Eragon wondered what else of import was happening in Alagazia that he was unaware of.
"Roran!"
With a pang of guilt, Eragon realized that it had been weeks since he last thought of his cousin, and even longer since he scried him on the way to Ellesmira. At Eragon's command, the mirror revealed 2 figures standing against a pure white background. It took Eragon a long moment to recognize the man on the right as Roran. He was garbed in travel-worn clothes, a hammer was stuck under his belt, a thick beard obscured his face, and he bore a haunted expression that bespoke desperation. To the left was Jode. The men surged up and down, accompanied by the thunderous crash of waves, which masked anything they said. After a while, Roran turned and walked along what Eragon assumed was the deck of a ship, bringing dozens of other villagers into view.
"Where are they? And why is Jode with them?" demanded Eragon, bewildered.
Diverting the magic, he scried in quick succession Tirm, shocked to see that the city's wharves had been destroyed, Therensford, Garrow's old farm, and then Carverhall, whereupon Eragon uttered a wounded cry.
The village was gone!
Every building, including Horst's magnificent house, had been burned to the ground. Carverhall no longer existed, except as a sooty blot beside the Anora River. The sole remaining inhabitants were 4 grey wolves that loped through the wreckage. The mirror dropped from Eragon's hand and shattered across the floor. He leaned against Saphira, tears burning in his eyes as he grieved anew for his lost home. Saphira hummed deep in her chest and brushed his arm with the side of her jaw, enveloping him in a warm blanket of sympathy.
"Take comfort, little one. At least your friends are still alive."
He shuddered and felt a hard core of determination coalesce in his belly. "We have remained sequestered from the world for far too long. It's high time we leave Ellesmira and confront our fate, whatever it may be. For now, Roran must fend for himself. But the Varden, we can help.
"Is it time to fight, Aragorn?"
asked Saphira, an odd note of formality in her voice. He knew what she meant. Was it time to challenge the Empire head-on? Time to kill and rampage to the limit of their considerable abilities? Time to unleash every ounce of their rage until Galbatorix lay dead before them? Was it time to commit themselves to a campaign that could take decades to resolve? It is time. Gifts. Aragorn packed his belongings in less than 5 minutes. He took the saddle Oromis had given them, strapped it onto Saphira, then slung his bags over her back and buckled them down. Saphira tossed her head, nostrils flared, and said,
"I will wait for you at the field."
With a roar, she launched herself from the treehouse, unfolding her blue wings in midair, and flew off, skimming the forest canopy. Quick as an elf, Aragorn ran to Tel Dari Hall, where he found Oric sitting in his usual corner playing a game of runes. The dwarf greeted him with a hearty slap on the arm.
"Aragorn, what brings you here at this time of the morn? I thought you'd be off banging swords with Vanner."
"Saphira and I are leaving," said Aragorn. Oric stopped with his mouth open, then narrowed his eyes, going serious.
"You've had news?"
"I'll tell you about it later. Do you want to come?"
"To Surda?"
"Aye." A wide smile broke across Oric's hairy face.
"You'd have to clap me in irons before I'd stay behind. I've done nothing in Ellesmere but grow fat and lazy. A bit of excitement will do me good. When do we leave?"
"As soon as possible. Gather your things and meet us at the sparring grounds. Can you scrounge up a week's worth of provisions for the two of us?"
"A week's? But that won't..."
"We're flying on Saphira." The skin above Oric's beard turned pale.
"We dwarves don't do well with heights, Aragorn. We don't do well at all. It'd be better if we could ride horses, like we did coming here."
Aragorn shook his head. "That would take too long. Besides, it's easy to ride Saphira. She'll catch you if you fall." Oric grunted, appearing both queasy and unconvinced. Leaving the hall, Aragorn sped through the Sylvan City until he rejoined Saphira, and then they flew to the crags of Telnair. Oromis was sitting upon Gleda's right forearm when they landed in the clearing. The dragon's scales gilded the landscape with countless chips of golden light. Neither elf nor dragon stirred. Descending from Saphira's back, Aragorn bowed.
"Master Gleda! Master Oromis!"
Gleda said,
"You have taken it upon yourself to return to the Varden, have you not?"
"We have,"
replied Saphira. Aragorn's sense of betrayal overcame his self-restraint.
"Why did you hide the truth from us? Are you so determined to keep us here that you must resort to such underhand trickery? The Varden are about to be attacked, and you didn't even mention it."
Calm as ever, Oromis asked,
"Do you wish to hear why?"
"Very much, master,"
said Saphira before Aragorn could respond. In private, she scolded him, growling,
"Be polite."
"We withheld the tidings for two reasons. Chief among them was that we ourselves did not know until 9 days passed that the Varden were threatened, and the true size, location, and movements of the Empire's troops remained concealed from us until 3 days after that, when Lord Dathadur pierced the spells Galbatorix used to deceive our scrying."
"That still doesn't explain why you said nothing of this," Aragorn scowled. "Not only that, but once you discovered that the Varden were in danger, why didn't Islanzadi rouse the elves to fight? Are we not allies?"
"She has roused the elves, Aragorn. The forest echoes with the ring of hammers, the tramp of armoured boots, and the grief of those who are about to be parted. For the first time in a century, our race is set to emerge from Duweldenvarden and challenge our greatest foe. The time has come for elves to once more walk openly in Alagazia." Gently, Oromis added, "You have been distracted of late, Aragorn, and I understand why. Now you must look beyond yourself. The world demands your attention."
Shamefaced, all Aragorn could say was, "I am sorry, master."
He remembered Blogden's words and allowed himself a bitter smile. I'm as blind as a bat.
Hardly, Aragorn. You have done well, considering the enormous responsibilities we have asked you to shoulder.
Aramis looked at him gravely.
We expect to receive a missive from Nasuada in the next few days, requesting assistance from Islanzadi, and that you rejoin the Varden. I intended to inform you of the Varden's predicament then, when you would still have enough time to reach Sorda before swords are drawn. If I told you earlier, you would have been honour-bound to abandon your training and rush to the defence of your liege lord. That is why I and Islanzadi held our tongues.
My training won't matter if the Varden are destroyed.
No, but you may be the only person who can prevent them from being destroyed, for a chance exists, slim but terrible, that Galbatorix will be present at this battle. It is far too late for our warriors to assist the Varden, which means that if Galbatorix is indeed there, you shall confront him alone, without the protection of our spellweavers. Under those circumstances, it seemed vital that your training continue for as long as possible.
In an instant, Aragorn's anger melted away and was replaced with a cold, hard, and brutally practical mindset, as he understood the necessity for Aramis's silence. Personal feelings were irrelevant in a situation as dire as theirs. With a flat voice, he said, "You were right. My oath of fealty compels me to ensure the safety of Nasuada and the Varden. However, I am not ready to confront Galbatorix. Not yet, at least."
"My suggestion," said Aramis, "is that if Galbatorix reveals himself, do everything you can to distract him from the Varden until the battle is decided for good or for ill, and avoid directly fighting him. Before you go, I ask but one thing, that you and Saphira vow that once events permit, you will return here to complete your training, for you still have much to learn."
"We shall return,"
pledged Saphira, binding herself in the ancient language. "We shall return," repeated Aragorn, and sealed their fate. Appearing satisfied, Aramis reached behind himself and produced an embroidered red pouch that he tugged open.
"In anticipation of your departure, I gathered together three gifts for you, Aragorn."
From the pouch he withdrew a silver bottle.
"First, some Thalnerve I augmented with my own enchantments. This potion can sustain you when all else fails, and you may find its properties useful in other circumstances as well. Drink it sparingly, for I only had time to prepare a few mouthfuls."
He handed the bottle to Aragorn, then removed a long black and blue sword belt from the pouch. The belt felt unusually thick and heavy to Aragorn when he ran it through his hands. It was made of cloth threads, woven together in an interlocking pattern that depicted a coiling liane vine. At Aramis's instruction, Aragorn pulled at a tassel at the end of the belt and gasped as a strip in its centre slid back to expose 12 diamonds, each an inch across. 4 diamonds were white, 4 were black, and the remainder were red, blue, yellow, and brown. They glittered, cold and brilliant, like ice in the dawn, casting a rainbow of multicoloured specks onto Aragorn's hands.
"Master!"
Aragorn shook his head at a loss for words for several breaths. "Is it safe to give this to me?"
"Guard it well, so that none are tempted to steal it. This is the belt of Beloth the Wise, who you read of in your history of the Year of Darkness, and is one of the great treasures of the Riders. These are the most perfect gems the Riders could find. Some we traded for with the dwarves, others we won in battle or mined ourselves. The stones have no magic of their own, but you may use them as repositories for your power and draw upon that reserve when in need. This, in addition to the ruby set in Zarok's pommel, will allow you to amass a store of energy so that you do not become unduly exhausted casting spells in battle, or even when confronting enemy magicians."
Last, Aramis brought out a thin scroll protected inside a wooden tube that was decorated with a bas-relief sculpture of the Manoa tree. Unfurling the scroll, Aragorn saw the poem he had recited at the Agati Blodron. It was lettered in Aramis's finest calligraphy and illustrated with the elf's detailed ink paintings. Plants and animals twined together inside the outline of the first glyph of each quatrain, while delicate scrollwork traced the columns of words and framed the images.
"I thought," said Oromis, "that you would appreciate a copy for yourself."
Eragon stood with 12 priceless diamonds in one hand and Oromis's scroll in the other, and he knew that it was the scroll he deemed the most precious. Eragon bowed, and reduced to the simplest language by the depth of his gratitude, said, "Thank you, Master." Then Oromis surprised Eragon by initiating the elves' traditional greeting, and thereby indicating his respect for Eragon.
"May good fortune rule over you."
"May the stars watch over you."
"And may peace live in your heart," finished the silver-haired elf. He repeated the exchange with Saphira. "Now go, and fly as fast as the north wind, knowing that you, Saphira Brightscales and Eragon Shadeslayer, carry the blessing of Oromis, last scion of House Thrandurin, he who is both the Morning Sage and the cripple who is whole."
"And mine as well," added Glader.
Extending his neck, he touched the tip of his nose to Saphira's, his gold eyes glittering like swirling pools of embers.
"Remember to keep your heart safe, Saphira,"
she hummed in response. They parted with solemn farewells. Saphira soared over the tangled forest, and Oromis and Glader dwindled behind them, lonely on the crags. Despite the hardships of his stay in Ellesmira, Eragon would miss being among the elves, for with them he had found the closest thing to a home since fleeing Palancar Valley. "I leave here a changed man," he thought, and closed his eyes, clinging to Saphira. Before going to meet with Oric, they made one more stop, Tildari Hall. Saphira landed in the enclosed gardens, careful not to damage any of the plants with her tail or claws. Without waiting for her to crouch, Eragon leaped straight to the ground, a drop that would have injured him before. A male elf came out, touched his lips with his first two fingers, and asked if he could help them. When Eragon replied that he sought an audience with Islan Zardi, the elf said, "Please wait here, Silverhand." Not 5 minutes later, the queen herself emerged from the wooded depths of Tildari Hall, her crimson tunic like a drop of blood among the white-robed elf lords and ladies who accompanied her. After the appropriate forms of address were observed, she said, "Oromis informed me of your intention to leave us. I am displeased by this, but one cannot resist the will of fate."
"No, Your Majesty. Your Majesty, we came to pay our respects before departing. You have been most considerate of us, and we thank you and your house for clothing, lodging, and feeding us. We are in your debt."
"Never in our debt, Rider.
We but repaid a little of what we owe you and the dragons for our miserable failure in the fall. I am gratified, though, that you appreciate our hospitality." She paused. "When you arrive in Surda, convey my royal salutations to Lady Nasuada and King Orin, and inform them that our warriors will soon attack the northern half of the Empire. If fortune smiles upon us, we shall catch Galbatorix off guard, and, given time, divide his forces."
"As you wish. Also, know that I have dispatched 12 of our finest spellweavers to Surda. If you are still alive when they arrive, they will place themselves under your command, and do their best to shield you from danger, both night and day."
"Thank you, Your Majesty."
Islan Zardi extended a hand, and one of the elf lords handed her a shallow, unadorned wooden box.
"Oromis had his gifts for you, and I have mine. Let them remind you of your time spent with us under the dusky pines."
She opened the box, revealing a long, dark bow with reflexed limbs and curled tips, nestled on a bed of velvet. Silver fittings chased with dogwood leaves decorated the ears and grip of the bow. Beside it lay a quiver of new arrows fletched with white swan feathers.
Now that you share our strength, it seems only proper that you should have one of our bows. I sang it myself from a yew tree. The string will never break, and so long as you use these arrows, you will be hard-pressed to miss your target, even if the wind should gust during your shot. Once again, Aragorn was overwhelmed by the elf's generosity. He bowed.
What can I say, my lady?
You honour me, that you saw fit to give me the labour of your own hands. Islanzadi nodded, as if agreeing with him, then stepped past him and said, Saphira, I brought you no gifts, because I could think of nothing you might need or want. But if there is aught of ours you desire, name it, and it shall be yours.
Dragons, said Saphira, do not require possessions to be happy. What use have we for riches when our hides are more glorious than any treasure hoard in existence? No, I am content with the kindness that you have shown Aragorn.
Then Islanzadi bid them a safe journey. Sweeping around, her red cape billowing from her shoulders, she made to leave the gardens, only to stop at the edge of the pleasance and say, And Aragorn?
Yes, Your Majesty.
When you meet with Arya, please express my affection to her, and tell her that she is sorely missed in Ellesmere. The words were stiff and formal. Without waiting for a reply, she strode away, and disappeared among the shadowed boles that guarded the interior of Teildari Hall, followed by the elf lords and ladies. It took Saphira less than a minute to fly to the sparring field, where Oryk sat on his bulging pack, tossing his war axe from one hand to the other and scowling ferociously.
"About time you got here,"
he grumbled. He stood and slipped the axe back under his belt. Aragorn apologized for the delay, then tied Oryk's pack onto the back of his saddle. The dwarf eyed Saphira's shoulder, which loomed high above him.
"And how, by Morgoth's blackbeard, am I supposed to get up there? A cliff has more handholds than you, Saphira."
"Here,"
she said. She lay flat on her belly and pushed her right hind leg out as far as she could, forming a knobby ramp. Pulling himself onto her shin with a loud "huff," Oryk crawled up her leg on hands and knees. A small jet of flame burst from Saphira's nostrils as she snorted,
"Hurry up! That tickles!"
Oryk paused on the ledge of her haunches, then placed one foot on either side of Saphira's spine and carefully walked his way up her back toward the saddle. He tapped one of the ivory spikes between his legs and said,
"There be as good a way to lose your manhood as ever I've seen."
Aragorn grinned. "Don't slip!" When Oryk lowered himself onto the front of the saddle, Aragorn mounted Saphira and sat behind the dwarf. To hold Oryk in place when Saphira turned or inverted, Aragorn loosened the thongs that were meant to secure his arms and had Oryk put his legs through them. As Saphira rose to her full height, Oryk swayed, then clutched the spike in front of him.
"Gah! Aragorn, don't let me open my eyes until we're in the air, else I fear I'll be sick! This is unnatural, it is. Dwarves aren't meant to ride dragons. It's never been done before."
"Never?"
Oryk shook his head without answering. Clusters of elves drifted out of Duweldenvarden, gathered along the edge of the field, and with solemn expressions watched Saphira lift her translucent wings in preparation to take off. Aragorn tightened his grip as he felt her mighty thews bunch underneath his legs. With a rush of acceleration, Saphira launched herself into the azure sky, flapping swift and hard to rise above the giant trees. She wheeled over the vast forest, spiralling upward as she gained altitude, and then aimed herself south, toward the Hadarach Desert. Though the wind was loud in Aragorn's ears, he heard an elf woman in Ellesmere raise her clear voice in song, as he had when they first arrived. She sang,
"Away, away, you shall fly away, o'er the peaks and vales to the lands beyond. Away, away, you shall fly away, and never return to me."
The Maw of the Ocean. The obsidian seas heaved underneath the Dragonwing, propelling the ship high in the air.
There it teetered on the precipitous crest of a foam-capped swell, before pitching forward and racing down the face of the wave into the black trough below. Billows of stinging mist drove through the frigid air as the wind groaned and howled like a monstrous spirit. Roran clung to the starboard rigging at the waist of the ship and retched over the gunwale. Nothing came up but sour bile. He had prided himself that his stomach never bothered him while on Clovis's barges, but the storm they raced before was so violent that even Uthar's men, seasoned tars each and every one, had difficulty keeping their whiskey down. It felt like a boulder of ice clouted Roran between the shoulder blades as a wave struck the ship crossways, drenching the deck before draining through the scuppers and pouring back into the frothing, furrowed, furious ocean from whence it came. Roran wiped the salty water from his eyes with fingers as clumsy as frozen lumps of wood and squinted toward the inky horizon to the aft. "Maybe this will shake them off our scent." Three black-sailed sloops had pursued them ever since they passed the iron cliffs and rounded what Job dubbed Edur Karthun Gave, and Uthar identified as Rathbar's spur.
"The tailbone and a spine, that's what it be," Uthar said, grinning.
The sloops were faster than the Dragonwing, weighed down with villagers as it was, and had quickly gained upon the merchant ship until they were close enough to exchange volleys of arrows. Worst of all, it seemed that the lead sloop carried a magician, for its arrows were uncannily accurate, splitting ropes, destroying ballistae, and clogging the blocks. From their attacks, Roran deduced that the Empire no longer cared about capturing him, and only wanted to stop him from finding sanctuary with the Varden. He had just been preparing the villagers to repel boarding parties when the clouds above ripened to a bruised purple, heavy with rain, and a ravening tempest blew in from the northwest. At the present, Uthar had the Dragonwing tacked crossways to the wind, heading toward the southern isles, where he hoped to elude the sloops among the shoals and coves of Beerland. A sheet of horizontal lightning flickered between two bulbous thunderheads, and the world became a tableau of pale marble, before darkness reigned once more. Every blinding flash imprinted a motionless scene upon Roran's eyes that lingered, pulsing, long after the brazen bolts vanished. Then came another round of forked lightning, and Roran saw, as if in a series of monochrome paintings, the mizzen topmast twist, crack, and topple into the thrashing sea, port amidships. Grabbing a lifeline, Roran pulled himself to the quarterdeck, and in unison with Bondon, hacked through the cables that still connected the topmast to the Dragonwing, and dragged the stern low in the water. The ropes writhed like snakes as they were cut. Afterward, Roran sank to the deck, his right arm hooked through the gunwale to hold himself in place as the ship dropped 20-30 feet between waves. A swell washed over him, leaching the warmth from his bones. Shivers racked his body.
"Don't let me die here," he pleaded. Though whom he addressed he knew not. "Not in these cruel waves. My task is yet unfinished."
During that long night he clung to his memories of Katrina, drawing solace from them when he grew weary and hope threatened to desert him. The storm lasted 2 full days and broke during the wee hours of the night. The following morning brought with it a pale green dawn, clear skies, and 3 black sails riding the northern horizon. To the southwest, the hazy outline of Beerland lay underneath a shelf of clouds gathered about the ridged mountain that dominated the island. Roran, Jode, and Uthar met in a small forecabin, since the captain's stateroom was given over to the infirm, where Uthar unrolled sea charts on the table and tapped a point above Beerland.
"This'd be where we are now," he said.
He reached for a larger map of Alagazia's coastline and tapped the mouth of the Jeet River.
"And this'd be our destination, since food won't last us to Reevestone. How we get there, though, without being overtaken is beyond me. Without our mizzen t'gallant, those accursed sloops will catch us by noon tomorrow, even if we manage the sails well."
"Can we replace the mast?" asked Jode. "Vessels of this size carry spars to make just such repairs."
Uthar shrugged.
"We could, provided we had a proper ship's carpenter among us. Seeing as we don't, I'd rather not let inexperienced hands mount a spar, only to have it crash down on deck and perhaps injure somebody."
Roran said, "If it weren't for the magician or magicians, I'd say we should stand and fight,
since we far outnumber the crews of the sloops. As it is, I'm chary of battle. It seems unlikely that we could prevail, considering how many ships sent to help the Varden have disappeared. Grunting, Uthar drew a circle around their current position.
This should be how far we can sail by tomorrow evening, assuming the wind stays with us. We could make landfall somewhere on Beerland or near if we wanted, but I can't see how that'd help us. We'd be trapped. The soldiers on those sloops, or the Razak or Galbatorix himself, could hunt us at his leisure.
Roran scowled as he considered their options. A fight with the sloops appeared inevitable. For several minutes the cabin was silent except for the slap of waves against the hull. Then Jode placed his finger on the map between Beerland and Nia, looked at Uther, and asked, "What about the boar's eye?" To Roran's amazement, the scarred sailor actually blanched.
"I'd not risk that, Master Jode, not on my life. I'd rather face the sloops and die in the open sea than go to that doomed place. There has consumed twice as many ships as in Galbatorix's fleet."
"I seem to recall reading," said Jode, leaning back in his chair, "that the passage is perfectly safe at high tide and low tide. Is that not so?" With great and evident reluctance, Uthar admitted,
"Aye, but the eye is so wide it requires the most precise timing to cross without being destroyed. We'd be hard-pressed to accomplish that with the sloops near on our tail."
"If we could, though," pressed Jode, "if we could time it right, the sloops would be wrecked, or, if their nerve failed them, forced to circumvent near. It would give us time to find a place to hide along Beerland."
If, you'd send us to the crushing deep, you would."
"Come now, Uthar, your fear is unreasoning. What I propose is dangerous, I admit, but no more than fleeing Tirm was. Or do you doubt your ability to sail the gap? Are you not man enough to do it?"
Uthar crossed his bare arms. "You've never seen the eye, have you, sir?"
"I can't say I have."
"It's not that I'm not man enough, but that the eye far exceeds the strength of men. It puts to shame our biggest ships, our grandest buildings, and anything else you'd care to name. Tempting it would be like trying to outrun an avalanche. You might succeed, but then you just as well might be ground into dust."
"What," asked Roran, "is this boar's eye?"
"The all-devouring maw of the ocean," proclaimed Uthar.
In a milder tone, Jode said, "It's a whirlpool, Roran. The eye forms as the result of tidal currents that collide between Beerland and Nia. When the tide waxes, the eye rotates north to west. When the tide wanes, it rotates north to east."
"That doesn't sound so dangerous."
Uthar shook his head, Q whipping the sides of his windburned neck, and laughed.
"Not so dangerous," he says. "Ha!"
"What you fail to comprehend," continued Jode, "is the size of the vortex. On average, the centre of the eye is a league in diameter, while the arms of the pool can be anywhere from 10 to 15 miles across. Ships unlucky enough to be snared by the eye are borne down to the floor of the ocean and dashed against the jagged rocks therein. Remnants of the vessels are often found as flotsam on the beaches of the two islands."
"Would anyone expect us to take this route?" Roran queried.
"No, and for good reason," growled Uthar.
Jode shook his head at the same time.
"Is it even possible for us to cross the eye?"
"It'd be a blasted fool thing to do."
Roran nodded. "I know it's not something you want to risk, Uthar, but our options are limited. I'm no seaman, so I must rely upon your judgment. Can we cross the eye?" The captain hesitated.
"Maybe, maybe not. You'd have to be stark raving mad to go nearer than 5 miles of that monster."
Pulling out his hammer, Roran banged it on the table, leaving a dent a half inch deep.
"Then I'm stark raving mad."
He held Uthar's gaze until the sailor shifted with discomfort. "Must I remind you, we've only gotten this far by doing what Quibbling Worrywart said couldn't or shouldn't be done. We of Carvajal dared to abandon our homes and cross the spine. Jode dared to imagine we could steal the dragon wing. What will you dare, Uthar? If we can brave the eye and live to tell the tale, you shall be hailed as one of the greatest mariners in history. Now answer me, and answer me well and true. Can this be done?" Uthar drew a hand over his face. When he spoke, it was in a low voice, as